Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
As a Republican senator from Maine, Olympia Snow was known for her willingness to stand alone. A moderate with independent views, she had substantial influence in the health care debate as both sides vied for her vote. Earlier this year, she left the Senate out of frustration, she says, with the inability to get anything done. Her new book, Fighting for Common Ground: How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress, is a memoir, but also offers some solutions to some political troubles. It is a great pleasure to welcome Senator Olympia Snow to the program. A delight to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe, for having me. I appreciate it.
It is wonderful to have you here, and I so enjoyed the book. The subtitle is How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. Before we talk and get into your prescription, how did we get to this point?
It's a very good question. And I pondered it a lot. There's so many reasons, I guess, that could be attributed to why we are where we are today. I mean, obviously, the political divisions that, you know, are steeped in the political realm, you know, of campaigns, more money, outside groups. But at the same time, I think as well, the divisions, you know, and the way we communicate. Now, I always used to say I was sort of viewed through the prism of MSNBC and Fox News, and sort of what's happened, the divide. And, you know, we've read about, you know, the book with a big sort, you know, people living with like-minded individuals or speaking to like-minded individuals. And that has all infused the policymaking process in Washington. It's gotten to be a stand down. And for some reason, people think the only way you convey a point of view is just to oppose the other side without sorting through the issues. It wasn't that there was, you know, mild eras, you know, in Congress. But rather what it was is that you had your fierce, ferocious debates, but at the end of the day, you knew you were going to come to some kind of solution. In some cases, you didn't. But you at least tried, and you worked through a legitimate, transparent process, which isn't what's happening today. And it became like a parliamentary system in the Senate. You know, each side offered their political party position for the political base, and neither side could prevail because they didn't have the votes. And then there was a stand down, and it didn't go any further than that, other than they're going to take it to the next election. And that's why we've gotten into this perpetual treadmill of the status quo.
I was struck while reading your book, because we all think of civil discourse at an all-time low in Congress and in politics. But it's, as you point out, it is at a low for us as Americans. And you do have to wonder if we need to understand that as humans and human nature before we can expect it from our legislators.
It's true. I think we have to engage in our own self-analysis and what we want. And that, frankly, we get the government we demand. And if we want change, then we have to change it, and we have to change. And I think, you know, it's interesting, and this is what contributed to my decision. As I traveled the country, you know, I had to do my fundraising outside of Maine for most part because I couldn't raise all my money in Maine. So I got a chance to talk to people not only in my state all the time, and I crossed the country and talked to people on both sides of the political spectrum. And what surprised me is hearing from people that even though they felt strongly about their views, they could have been strong Republicans, strong Democrats, at the end of the day, they wanted their government to work. And what made them fearful is what they were seeing in Washington at a time when they should be rising to the highest levels of legislative leadership. They saw that Congress was incapacitated to reach any solutions, couldn't make a decision. Some people were saying to me, if they would just make a decision, but couldn't make a decision. And I think that's what has concerned people, I think, mostly about the fact that they're disabled, you know, from any decision making.
Is that because, as a body, they're always running? There is always a political element to what they do. If that were not so paramount, would we have seen the gun vote that we saw?
Right. And, you know, it's interesting about that because people say to me, well, you know, there's 90-95% support. How is it?
Right.
And obviously that can break down according to, you know, regions. That's more less political and partisan than it is geographic and regional. But nevertheless, I think it speaks to a larger question about the politics. And it's interesting because usually the dust would settle after an election and you get a year of legislating and focus on issues. But that's not happening anymore. It's just a perpetual campaign. And so ultimately everything is done or viewed through the political prism. And it becomes the end all and be all. And I firmly believe, especially for I think a lot of newcomers to the process, both in the House and Senate, that they've lost sight of what their purpose of public service is all about. Now, it doesn't mean to say there are times you want to block a piece of legislation, frankly. I mean, that's another, but not to the exclusion of everything. And that's what it's become, and to the detriment of the country. Every episode that's occurred as far as a crisis, whether it's the debt ceiling or the fiscal cliff or sequestration, automatic cuts, whatever the case is, it's all been manufactured by Congress. It's not something that came along that was totally unexpected.
You do have to wonder of just looking at your situation of being of standing alone and an independent voice of take the health care vote, of how you were looked at during that as we have to win her, and the power that you had in that moment, which you would think would empower others to say, okay, I'm going to be independent as well, and I'm going to stand out and say what I think and feel. But instead, you're the rarity.
Yes, because most people don't want to take the risk. I think many people saw, you know, the things that I endured. I always remember when Jim Jeffords converted.
Right.
You know, he
in Vermont.
In Vermont, and he was a good friend, and we used to have lunch every week, a group of us as moderates and everything, and he made the decision to leave. And one of my colleagues said on the Republican side, he said, gosh, Olympia, you take more guff than anybody, you know, in the Senate, because I was willing to stand out. And that's because I firmly believe you have to do the right thing. You got to give it a chance. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But my constituents wouldn't countenance walking away from the table without at least giving it a chance. And that's how I always firmly believed, is that give it a chance if it doesn't work. And I'm always willing to listen to somebody else. They may have a better idea, may have a better appreciation of that perspective. But no one's giving that opportunity. And they don't want to invite the political risk and the wrath that comes with it in the final analysis. But I have been doing that and playing that role for so long that I just could withstand it more than most and just took it as part of the daily job.
You touched on this a moment ago, but can you point to moments in your career where the system worked? Bipartisanship was exemplary.
Yes. For example, the E-rate, I cite this one when I worked with Jay Rockefeller, and it's a good example of how when you have a legitimate legislative process and you have amendments and you work through the issues, you can fight for something. And we created the E-rate, which is known as wiring all the classrooms across America. And that was significant at the time because it was the beginning of the Internet age, 1996, and we were rewriting the Telecommunications Act for the first time since 1934. And we used the same principles embedded in that law about applying telephones service to all parts of the country. So we said, well, you know, we got to wire the classrooms so that all classrooms are wired to the information age so they're not have and have not. And it was a big battle. It started in the committee through an amendment. We enjoined our efforts. I had the schools and libraries. He had rural health care facilities. He said, let's get together and do it. And we had to fight many battles in the committee, on the floor, through the regulatory process, everything. And it prevailed, but it was based on the merits of the issue. People argued the debate on the issue. And that's what makes it so exciting. That's what I love about debates, is that it is possible to make a difference on these issues. And ultimately, you know, it was described as one of the top 25, and we were ranked fourth, along with Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, as transforming education technology in a generation. I mean, that's what you can do by virtue of amendment and aligning forces. And I had to be the one Republican to join with him to make it happen, because our Republicans had been told not to offer any amendments. They didn't want any amendments. And I insisted I was going to have this amendment. And Jay kept coming over to me. Are you going to still offer your amendment? I know there's a lot of pressure. The Republicans were in the majority at the time. And he kept coming, are you sure? You sure? I said, don't worry, Jay. I'm there. I'm going to. Absolutely. And you just have to, when you know something's right or you're passionate about something, and I tell this to young people, you can't be afraid to stand alone. And that probably goes back to my own childhood. And that's why I talk about the personal stuff, because that really shaped my approach to the job.
About that, an independence that comes very young. You were 8 when you lost your mother. A year later, you're away at school and you find out that your father had a heart attack. That has to change everything.
It does. And I was at a Greek school in New York, and I get the news. You know, it's paralyzing, I mean, to think. And I was, you know, close to my father. And as I said in the book, I would write him every day. So I made sure he got letters from me 6 days a week. But, of course, all of a sudden you realize you now lost both parents. But I was fortunate because, you know, I was at school and had a lot of support. And I had my aunt and uncle in Maine and my 5 cousins and my brother. And so, you know, I just had strong faith, frankly. And so it just was what allowed me to sustain myself. But I, in my own way, I thought I knew I was on my own on some level. And so I had to, you know, really start thinking for myself. Mm. And so I had to have belief in what I could do for myself. And so maybe that gave me the confidence in some ways to be able to withstand and be buffeted by the pressures. I could withstand all of that from the day to day.
It makes you more confident and matures you faster, I assume.
Much more quickly. Absolutely. You grow up pretty quickly. There's nobody worrying for you. You have to worry for yourself and, you know, take care of the day-to-day in many ways, even though I was at school. I mean, you know, you have to, and I did. And so it made me think for myself. And to reason, you know, right or wrong, whatever I did. It was just, the fact is I had to sort through it in my own way along, knowing that I was on my own. And so I just decided to try to make it as best as I could and in a positive fashion, and just kept looking ahead.
And then just over a decade and a half later, as you are in your 20s, 26 mm-hmm. years old, your husband is killed in an accident. He is a politician. And here again, you are alone. Did your childhood in any way prepare you for that? Because all of this was, they were there and then they weren't.
Yeah, right. It did. I knew what I was going to be dealing with. And so I was fully, you know, realistic about the dimensions of, you know, my loss of a husband. And then, you know, so it helped to prepare me. But then it was an issue that all of a sudden, you know, I didn't realize it was possible to, you know, lose your husband. So it took me, you know, time to work it through. And I gave it the time that was necessary. You know, I did run for his seat in the legislature, and that certainly turned out it helped. I didn't know what it was going to do, but I was interested in politics. So when people said, you know, you really should do it, I decided to do it, even though it wasn't the ideal moment. But as I have told so many people who've lost loved ones, and especially those families who've lost their children in Iraq and Afghanistan, or spouses, or a parent, or whatever, I have talked to them, and I give them, you know, what helped me through that, and I could share that with them, even if it wasn't the same circumstance, but it was the same outcome and the same painful reality, and what things worked for me that might help them to get through it. So I could share that with them, and I tried to in all instances with everyone who lost a loved one.
And not to get overly psychological, but you decide to run for your husband's seat in the legislature. And at what point of that was dealing with the grief or trying to fulfill what he had set out to do And how much of it was, do you think, trying to start your own political life?
Yeah, and I wasn't sure, when I went there, because obviously I didn't know what to expect, trying to separate it out. And so I took it day by day. And I figured that once that term was completed, which was, most of it, it was about 4 months in, just about a little less than 4 months into his term of 2 years, I decided that I would have to run again to see how it really felt under different circumstances and whether or not it would work for me and it was right for me and for the right reasons. And so ultimately it did. Little did I know it would become a 40-year journey in public service with that one decision. When I was at the fork of the road, literally, and I had to make a quick decision under tough circumstances, knowing what I had to do for a campaign, because I had a campaign and just had gone through it. And I thought, okay, but it was a 40-year journey in public service. It was my calling.
And not to gloss over a 40-year term, of course, but then comes the decision of, all right, it's time to go.
Yeah.
And I would assume equally difficult in saying, now's the time, and more bittersweet, the reasons why.
Right. It was with deep regret for the reasons in which I made it. And it completely surprised me. That was another. I mean, the interesting part about that is I brought it upon myself in making the decision that I did not intend to make. I mean, it was not anything I was thinking about. And so I'd been working for a better part of 2 years when I, realized it was towards when I was coming close to the submitting my signatures. And as I said, I've been traveling the country talking to people in Maine. People kept asking me, well, is it going to change? What's going to make the dynamic change? So one night I decided to think about it as I was getting ready to submit my signature and said, well, how is it going to change really? And is it going to be more of the same? And I wasn't just content to being there for the sake of being there. I always said that if I didn't feel I could make a difference in changing it and reaching results, then I would leave. And I reached a conclusion that I could not change it the way it was, that I could not produce results with people I was representing. And I wasn't doing what I thought was consistent with my responsibilities. And I realized the politics of it was not going to change right then and there. It had to change from the outside. And I had to make a very fast decision, which was really hard. I mean, it was like, gripping me 24 hours a day, so for that limited period of time. Talk about pressure. And I wasn't sure when I announced, was I making the right decision? But I knew I wouldn't be content, feel right, just doing, that battle with no ability to change the result.
And at no time there's a feeling that there's someone who can come in and do it better. It's that the deck is so stacked against anyone who walks into that role that, okay, let's go back and rewrite the rules.
Right. Because the rules have changed because of the campaigns, the outside groups and influencing the division, the polarization. It's going to require the leadership on both sides, that men and women who can make the difference, and saying, listen, we're going to work across the aisle and sort through these issues rather than just making a political statement through political messaging. It's all become about messaging and base votes. And that's at one level, fine, but not to the exclusion of doing the work of the country. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we're lurching from crisis to crisis, by brinkmanship and deferral. I mean, if you think about it, everything's been manufactured over the last few years. It's not an event, major event that occurred because Congress was simply caught off guard or unanticipated between the president and Congress. We all created those because we refused to work in a fashion like starting at the new Congress and working on the debt ceiling. We procrastinated for a better part of 7 months came up to that final deadline. And the first deadline was in March for raising that debt ceiling in 2011. The initial deadline was in late March. And, you know, then the secretary deferred the deadline to May and then August. And when was it? The 11th hour, and we lost our AAA credit rating. When we had been told by Standard & Poor in April that would happen because of our political procrastination, the lack of predictability among policymakers, that in their words.
Obviously, there's frustration, but is there a point where you say to yourself, I know this wasn't your reason for leaving, but is there a point where you say to yourself, I'm not having fun going to work anymore?
What it was is that every morning I was always getting up thinking about what I was going to be able to achieve that day. If there's a problem put in front of me, I want to solve it. And that's what was not happening anymore. So I was thinking, is everybody else waking up every morning thinking, this is another can't-do day? I mean, it just was not in my DNA. And I realized, given that, I always say it was my, you know, Greek heritage on the Spartan side. You know, I'm a fighter, and I like to, you know, I never give up. And I just figured that if you can't change it here, and you don't have enough like-minded people who can change it, then you got to look for another way. And that's why I want to give voice to what people are feeling. Not only that, but to do something about it, because the things that can be done will have to change the incentives in the political system in recognizing that if we don't like the way government's working, then how can we change it?
I love one of the things that you bring up in the book, which just seems so simple, which is, all right, why don't you actually go to work for 5 days a week?
Exactly. You can't give these issues a couple of days a week, because what happens for people to understand, it's not as if people, well, they go home and they meet with their constituents, and that's always important. I went home every weekend, and I would come back on Sunday nights to be ready for Monday. But the point is that the machinery of Congress doesn't get up and running until there are votes. That draws people back. And people don't, you know, spend any more time in Washington than they have to. And that's well and good. But you have to be there long enough to concentrate on some very complicated issues. So what happens is, I always say, on Monday nights we'd have a bed check vote. Gets everybody back in town.
Sure, you're there.
Right. And then so Tuesday morning everything starts. And then by Thursday people are pressuring the leadership. Well, when can we leave? When can we leave? They're smelling what I call the jet fumes. And they're leaving town. And so you can't do what the demands are in this job in that period of time. And so no one's around. And that's the problem. You have to have full work weeks and concentrate that time and have a legislative agenda, create deadlines. I mean, the leadership should have done that. But now a lot of these decisions are concentrated in the hands of the leadership to make the decisions, craft them behind closed doors, and the committees aren't doing their jobs. They have hearings, but that becomes more about the political theater than it does about actually getting down to after those hearings, okay, how do we now craft legislation and work on it? The committee work has also disappeared in many ways. Now, I see what the Judiciary Committee is doing on immigration, having hundreds of members. People say, well, geez, is that a problem? No, it isn't. It gives everybody a voice in the system. You know, when a number of senators are denied the ability to offer amendments, that curtails the voices of those of whom they represent.
So you decided, I'm going to fight this from the outside. Mm-hmm. Did you know how that was going to take shape when you made the decision to leave?
No, I wasn't quite. You know, it was interesting because people asked me, there were a lot of reporters, and I remember going back to Maine doing a major press conference, and people said, well, how are you going to impact it? And I said, well, I'm going to speak out. But what I wasn't contemplating writing the book, frankly. I had some publishers who approached somebody in Washington, you know, Bob Barnett, who does many book arrangements, and he had said publishers had approached him. I had really never even thought about writing the book. I thought about speaking out and trying to do what I could to build a national following for change. I created Olympia's List to support consensus candidates, so that's going to be up and running for this next election. And so I said, well, how am I going to write a book? And then to dovetail it with this juncture because this is a pivotal period of time. It's either it's going to work in Congress or it's not for this Congress. There's only so much of a window of opportunity, viable window, to get things done, because then the politics interferes with the election. So if you're going to get anything, it has to happen now, between now, Thanksgiving, perhaps, you know, pushing it then. And so the ambition was to get it done. So that was trying. I guess if I had known what I was doing, I might not have done it because it's so difficult. But I, you know, managed to get it done for that reason, to get that book out there, to show people that there are ways in which to do it in real time. I want simple things that hands-on. You don't want something that's going to be 10 years down the road. There's some things, yes, on redistricting and that sort of thing, but you got to start that process now. You know, getting independent redistricting commissions, you know, through the legislatures and so on. But there are other things that can be done now because of social media, media in general, online technology, that can affect the change in the political dynamic. You look at the way Congress responded to the air traffic controllers, you know, right? They didn't want to sit on the planes, you know, bearing the wrath of their constituents
Exactly.
And the planes are idling on the tarmacs. Yeah, they wanted to get off. Yeah, you know, it's true, you see. And they responded. Well, the same can be true, you know, about insisting on building consensus. You know, as somebody once said, and it's so true, you know, bipartisanship is not a political theory. It's a political necessity.
So you've teamed with other former legislators.
Yes.
And are part of this coalition to go out and say, this is what we believe needs to be done.
Absolutely. This bipartisan policy center that I'm now a senior fellow, but it was co-founded by four former majority leaders of the United States Senate, Senator Daschle, Senator Mitchell, Senator Dolan, Senator Baker. They founded it in 2007. And we launched this week a Common Ground project for citizens, along with their Citizens for Political Reform. They'll give people an avenue. It's bipartisanpolicy.org, and a website where we're going to give them real-time information, insights on what's happening on legislation, what the stalemate is, what's holding it up, who you can contact, what are the options, what are the specific policy solutions that they can choose from that can make a difference. Where there are examples of bipartisanship, what are the states doing? And give examples of that as well, so that it's real time and hands on. I've created Olympia's List, as I said, which is you know olympiaslist.org as well, because I want to help those who are willing to support consensus in Congress. Also, I want people to know that they can impact change, like Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street. Frankly, they were able to mobilize. The same should be true for the American people. And I've traveled across this country. I've talked to a lot of campuses. Young people have a stake in the future, and they want to know what can they do about it. And so this is an avenue. And we're going to create a young, you know, we're actually creating another generational equity program, too, for college campuses as well, because they have so much at stake in what happens or doesn't happen currently in Congress and with the president.
One of the things that struck me about the book is all the problems that you've just talked about. But then also add to this, we have a gender problem.
Right.
We have a race problem. The representation is so out of whack. You have a great chapter in here about being a woman in the Senate and how you make strides and you think, okay, nothing's going to stop us. And then you watch that retreat instead of move forward.
Yeah, it is amazing how, you know, all of a sudden I really did think it was a retro debate. You know, when we're talking about contraceptive coverage. Actually, I had introduced a bill back in the late 90s, and it was actually Harry Reid and I both testified before a committee the day before 9/11 on this very on my legislation on health insurance policies. But again, that would have been an area where you could have addressed the conscience clause and the religious exceptions and so on. But unfortunately, on our side, they overreached and wanted to talk about, you know, broader health, you know, and allowing employers to, on any health reason, could, you know, not have to provide that coverage. I guess it's the point is that for the strides that we make, in some ways, we have gone backwards on some of these questions. And so we just have to continue to work it. And that means, you know, you have to have more women in the political system. You have to have more minorities. It has to be reflective of the broader population. Big difference. I remember talking to a former senator a few years ago who was in the cloakroom, and he'd served long before I did. I asked him, did he see any changes? Yes, he said the one thing he noticed, a big difference, was women in the Senate chamber. So, and now we have many more women than even at the time when she spoke. But it does make a difference to having those voices there. You're not always going to agree. But the point is that it's having that perspective, that part of society that represents, you know, more than half, being represented as well.
As we wrap up, I want to talk about one more thing that you just mentioned, and that is this window that we have right mm-hmm. now. And understand that. And I look and I said, okay, well, we have this window. This is where the opportunity can take place. So then we look at just the last week and a half, Benghazi, the IRS, the tapping of the AP phones. Now, when we look to the media, who's at fault there as far as changing that debate? Because all of the things that you have talked about are going to go to that back burner because politically, everyone is focused on those issues. The press certainly is focused on those issues. And as a result, the American people are focused on those issues.
Well, that's where presidential leadership and congressional leadership becomes essential, is moving on simultaneous tracks. There's no question we have to get answers and get to the heart of the matters of what's involved in all of these three, tragic events. And so, I mean, it just goes to fundamentally the heart of who we are as Americans. And, you know, you need transparency and accountability in government. And I've always, say to my staff, it's so important the way in which you exercise your responsibilities in dealing with people. And how, and I always have had healthy skepticism of government agencies in any event because they have power and they're removed. You know, they're insulated. And they're not responsive. I know I've had to deal with them, and fighting for my constituents. And I always said to my staff, you may have heard the problem 100 times, but you're going to deal with it as if you heard it for the first time. And you're going to fight as hard as you can, because if there's legitimacy to that complaint, then they have no other advocate. We're it. And because you're dealing with the scale and the breadth of government. And they have all the resources. They have all the time. And so that's what you're seeing here. In any event, it would require, I would hope, that they would agree how they're going to proceed on those three issues. The full investigation, have that happen, but at the same time, not to the exclusion of all these other issues as well. They have to happen. The debt reduction. We have to have a debt reduction plan, even though the deficit's coming down right now. That's temporary, because on the horizon is, 77 million beneficiaries are going to be going into retirement over the next 20 years, and the deficits are going to loom large on both on Medicare and on Social Security, and the burgeoning debt that is projected, basically starting in 2017 and beyond. And so, therefore, if we don't make changes now, the changes that will be required down the road will be wrenching and punitive. You need more latitude for time to, phase changes in. But otherwise, there will be no alternative down the road. So that's the problem. And if there are no changes in current law as we speak, we'll be totally on uncharted waters. We are right now. It's debt as a percentage of the gross domestic product. It's about 73% today as a percent of GDP. At the end of 2007, it was 36%. So and that's where it's going. But in any event, what I'm saying is that they should deal with all of those issues. They can if you have the right leadership to make sure that happens. And it's not one. They can do all of that if they put their minds to it.
So do we have the right leadership?
If they can change and rise to the occasion.
But it will take change.
To the highest level, it will take change. So they're going to have to change, and they're going to have to make their mindset and forget about the politics and get to the facts and what matters to this country. It's about the country right now. I mean, I tell people, you know, founding fathers, you know, they were deeply opinionated. You know, they weren't shrinking violets. I mean, they didn't come there to rubber stamp unanimous thinking. They arrived in Philadelphia and they had to sort it through and realize at the end of the day, it was about the whole. It was about creating the whole, the United States of America. And they ultimately had to build that consensus. And they relied on consensus and compromise to do it. And it took courage. It's taking courage today to facilitate solutions. As this late Senator Warren Rudman once said, politics is too important to be left to politicians. And so much is true. It's up to all of us. And we can do it in very, I think, simple steps that are concrete because we've now got the evolution of the media and the social media.
Olympia Snowe's new book is Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. It is published by Weinstein Books. Senator Snowe, it's a delight to have you here. I thank you so much for being with us and sharing your thoughts so eloquently.
Likewise, Joe. Thank you for having me, and I just appreciated this conversation here today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Again, the title of the book, Fighting for Common Ground, published by Weinstein Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.